All right, good evening, Erev Tov. Shalom Aleichem, Manishma. Copacetor, that's what you say. Copacetor, it's all good, it's all good. All right, I'm going to pass around a sheet. If you want to be on the Torah Tuesday email list, sign up. If you've been receiving emails, you don't have to sign up. It means you're on the list. You don't get flooded by emails. If you're curious about whether you should sign up or not, usually I send a reminder of the class, or when the website's updated with new material, or if there's a change in the schedule, such as we're not meeting, or things like that. But it's, you're not flooded. You're not on a church email list where you're going to get invited to stuff and all that. It's just Torah Tuesday information purposes stuff. So I'll pass it around, just take it and pass it down. And again, if you do receive emails from the Torah Tuesday class, you don't have to sign up for it, okay? Okay. We'll begin. Is Courtney here? Yes, Courtney is here. We'll begin with our blessing before the study of Torah. And we'll ask Javier Courtney, Brother Courtney, to do that. When you're ready, Courtney, if you'll take it away for us.
Eloheinu melech ha'olam, asher b'karbanu mikol ha'amim, v'natan lanu et torato, baruch atah Adonai, notin ha'torah. Bless the Lord, the Blessed One. Bless the Lord, the Blessed One, forever and ever. Blessed are you, Adonai, our God, King of the universe, who selected us from all the peoples and gave us his Torah. Blessed are you, Adonai, giver of the Torah. Amen.
Amen. All right, hopefully you were able to get a sheet. They were at the end of each table. Before we begin this week, I do want to tidy up last week. I just want to read to you something from the Chumash, the commentary in the Chumash. Now, keep in mind, this commentary, okay, it's not Christian, right? Not anything to do with Christians, right? This is the book by Jews for Jews, their commentary. In fact, it's not even new Jewish commentary. These are the medieval and the ancient sages. Remember, last week's parashat dealt a lot with Yom Kippur and atonement. And it began by reminding us of Aaron's sons. You remember them, Nadab and Abihu, and their death. And we talked about it wasn't that they were bad people. Okay, in fact, they're viewed as righteous individuals. In fact, righteous enough that their death atones. So what I'm about to read for you is just so that you understand, in case you ever hear it, either on a Christian side where it tries to make an exclusive claim that what Jesus said and did was brand new, and they had never heard of this suffering Messiah, or that the death of someone can bring atonement, you'll now know, well, that's not necessarily true. And if you also hear it on the other side, on the Jewish side, that says, that's not part of our theology, you can pull out their book, their commentators, and read them this. Why is the death of a righteous one, that is, such as Nadab and Abihu, mentioned in conjunction with the chapter of the Yom Kippur service? Because just as Yom Kippur brings atonement, so does the death of a righteous one bring atonement. Then it actually quotes where in the Jerusalem Talmud it makes that statement, Yoma 1:1. Meshech Chokmah explains that Yom Kippur is a time of favor, and it's thus an opportune time for atonement. And so when a righteous person, such as Nadab or Abihu, dies, and his soul ascends to the world of souls, the other righteous souls in heaven rejoice at his coming. And this good feeling above, remember, so as above, so below, this good feeling above inspires a spirit of forgiveness and atonement, hello, to the righteous person survivors on earth. This is its connection to Yom Kippur. So Nadab and Abihu are biblical Torah examples of the death of a righteous one affecting atonement from their commentators. Okay? So just wanted to touch base with you on that. I thought that was worth reading. All right, we're going to begin with our weekly Hebrew lesson there. Again, for those who are new, don't be overwhelmed by this or shocked. How do children learn to speak when they're babies? Not because you tell them subjects and verbs and make them memorize vocabulary lists. They learn it by being exposed to it and hearing it over and over and over until finally they start speaking it. Same thing is what we're doing here. Okay. In fact, the lesson this week is chapter 19, the second part of verse 2, because you guys already know how to do verse 1. You already know that Vadaber Adonai O Moshe stuff, right? And the Lord said to Moses, okay, you're good. Okay, you picked all that stuff up. So we're going to begin with the second part of Leviticus chapter 19, verse 2, which is where this parashat gets its name. Now, which way does Hebrew read from? You start on the right and you're going to go left. So the word on your page that looks like this, although a lot neater, that's where you're going to start. Okay? I'll read it and then I'll translate it a little bit, read it again, and we'll recite it together. So it's Kedoshim Tehiyu Ki Kedosh Ani Adonai Eloheichem. Now, Kedoshim, that is an adjective, and it's plural. Little grammatical hint for you. Most of the time when you have this im ending, which is this dot here in these two letters, the yod and the final mem, that's your clue that this is a plural word. Okay, most of the time, an im ending is a masculine plural ending. So it's going to have a little dot, and then the yod and the mem, and makes the im sound. Hebrew is built on the three-letter root system. That's where it's built in two, but most times it's three. Here, it's the kuf, the dalet, and the shin, or we'll go with here in English, kind of the k, the B, and that's its root. So anything that has these three letters is going to relate to what this word means. Okay, it's not going to always be the same. It's going to relate to it. Okay? So, Kedoshim. So this is holiness. It's an adjective. It's holiness or holy, but it's plural. Okay? So Kedoshim. It's plural adjective holy. Tehiyu. Now remember, when we're dealing with verbs, when we have the yod, that's your clue of third person masculine singular. The tav is your clue for what? Anyone remember? Second person, okay. This is a second person plural. It's in the imperfect tense, don't worry about that yet. But it's of the to be verb. So it's saying, you will be, but the you is plural. You will be kedoshim. You will be holy. Ki. We've had ki many times. Anyone remember what ki is? It can mean for. It's that particle conjunction. It can mean for, because, since. You know, you're kind of free to figure out which one of those works the best. So, you will be holy for, because, since, kadosh. Now, what three letters do you see there? It's been interrupted, but you see the kuf, the dalet, and the shin, right? It's been interrupted this time with a vav in there, but you still see those three blacks. So you know it's going to be something with holy. Well, this is the singular form of holy. Ani. Now this is important here because ani is the Hebrew word for I. Now, as we've encountered many times when we've done Hebrew verbs, if it's going to be he, she, I, you, you don't actually have a pronoun there, right? It's inferred by the verb. So when it's actually written out, it's a big point of emphasis. Okay, so this I is being emphasized because it's actually not really necessary. I, and then we have Adonai, the proper name of the Lord. And then Elohim. Now that chem ending is your clue for the your, the word your, okay? Meaning your plural. So you have you, plural, will be holy, because I, Adonai, your God, am holy. Now, I want you to think about this, because there's two ways you can understand this verse. Okay, you will be holy because I am holy. You can read it, number one, as a command. You will be this way because I'm this way. So you can look at it as a father telling his son, you will behave this way because Foster's behave this way. Okay? You can understand it that way. But you can also understand it as a more gift-oriented, grace-oriented. You will be, and you can also understand that you will become, you will be holy because I am holy. Because your God is holy, that's going to make you holy. It's actually the sense that's going on more in the parashat, because we're going to explore what does the word holy really mean in a Hebraic context. Okay, and it's slightly different, as you might imagine, than we're used to in the West. So, you will become holy because I am holy. I'm your God, and since I'm your God and I'm holy, that's going to make you holy. Equally, both ways. Now, when you're a Hebraic thinkers, and there are two possible ways to understand something, which is it? It's both. You get to wrestle with the kasha, the both of it, the bothness of it. So, Kedoshim, you. Ki Kedosh Ani Adonai Elohechem. All right, ready? Kedoshim, you. Ki Kedosh Ani Adonai Elohechem. All right, very good, very good. So, let's delve into this week's parashat, which is Leviticus chapters 19 and 20. Okay, that's the parashat of Kedoshim. So again, you see where the parashat gets its name. It's usually the first word, or sometimes words, that are kind of distinguishable within the parashat reading. And so this one is Kedoshim. So literally, the name of this parashat is Holiness. Okay. Now, there is a link between this week's parashat and the 10 words. What are the 10 words? It's what the church calls the 10 commandments, but they're not called that anywhere in the Bible. Okay? They're not called commandments or mitzvot at all. We even know it in the Latin. Decalog. Deca. 10. Log, logos, words. They're not commandments at all. They're never called that. Not. What the idea is that in these 10 words, because you've got to think Hebraic thinkers, just like this parashat is known by one word. If I say Kedoshim, you're supposed to immediately think Leviticus 19 and 20. Just by Kedoshim, just by that one word. And so each of the commandments has a key word. So there's 10 of these key words, if you will. Each of these words is actually a fractal of the entire Torah. Okay? So it's the entire Torah is contained within these 10 words. Now, we're usually accustomed to hearing that the 10 words or the 10 commandments are mentioned twice in the Torah, in Exodus and in Deuteronomy. And that's correct. They are mentioned in Exodus, as we learned when we did that parashat. And we'll learn that they are indeed in Deuteronomy when Moses reiterates the covenant and so forth. But Hebraic thinkers know they're actually mentioned three times in the Torah. The third time is right here in Leviticus, or actually the second time, is right here in this parashat. Leviticus Rabbah. What is Leviticus Rabbah? Remember the Midrash Rabbah?
Great.
It's a great collection of ethical and moral teachings from the oral traditions. Okay. It records how the sages saw the obvious parallel between this week's reading of Kedoshim and the 10 words. Because here in the text, we have the basic elements of God's entire Torah reiterated and in some cases actually expanded. But there is a very interesting and important lesson to be learned, first of all, from the arrangements of the chapters here in Kedoshim. Notice first how the opening section there in chapter 19 deals with relationships between members of the community. Deals with children to parents, parents to children, the community to the alien, man to his neighbor, and each of those towards the deaf and the blind and so forth. This opening section prohibits impartial judgment, slander, hating your fellow countrymen, being judgmental, bearing a grudge, and sexual misconduct. Sounds a lot like the Ten Commandments, right? Mm-hmm. That's why, and as you looked at the Hebrew, you'd see all kinds of nice verbal tallies going on. It commands loving one's neighbor. And how does Yeshua break down the commandments? Love God and love neighbor. This is actually Yeshua on teaching us. He understands Parashat Kedoshim deals with the ten words because he says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and your neighbors yourself." Now you'll notice if you go to Deuteronomy 6, what's missing from that? The neighbor part. More so, whereas he's actually combining different parashats because they're dealing with the same thing. Okay? So there's this emphasis on loving one's neighbor, respecting the station and life of others in the community, and giving equal advantage to the foreigner who dwells in the community. We're going to hit on some of these in more detail in a little bit. But after an emphasis upon loving one's neighbor, then follows the section that prohibits molech worship, spiritism, and sexual impurities of all kinds. Sexual impurities of all kinds is actually just an expansion of which of those 10 words? Adultery. You shall not commit adultery. This is where our catechism gets all of its wonderful "what does this mean" stuff. Okay, what does this mean? And it expands that one sentence commandment to like this. Now you know where they got it. The point of all of this is that in a society that's governed by the dividing mark of God's Torah, it could become an easy, indeed it could become a way of life, to foster a very hard and judgmental spirit. You can become quite spiritually proud of who you are. You can become proud of who you are as a covenant member of God's people and so forth. And it could foster a very hard, harsh spirit. That you're better than them, and so forth. And so this parashat is really trying to balance that and to show what the real understanding of these words are all about. If only one has an eye to justice without first having a heart that's governed by compassion, the heart will inevitably become hard, and the Torah, which has as its primary function to reveal the love of the Father to his children, it becomes a flogging stick in the hand of the self-righteous. And this is not God's design. We in the church call this Bible thumpers, right? They thump you on the head with their Bible. Okay, that's not an appropriate way to use the scriptures of God. It has to be balanced. If we look at our tree of life up here, what this parashat is wanting us to understand is there has to be a balance between what's called chesed in Hebrew, grace, unmerited favor, constant giving without expectation, and gevurah on the other side, which is justice and strictness and sternness and boundaries and saying no. And so the Torah, is this parashat saying these two have to come together into teseret, which means beautiful. They have to come to this beautiful harmony. So you have to know how to balance the Torah's justice and its fairness and its equity and its demands, but also God's loving kindness and his favorable disposition and his immense love for each and every one of us. You have to have this balance. And so if you're going to live in a community, then your community has to have these in balance as well. So God intends that his people, those who are marked by his word and those who guard his mitzvot, be equally known as compassionate people, forgiving people, merciful people, kind-hearted people. Knowing how to love each other is an integral step in learning how to love God. So we're going to see that this is actually a circle. When Yeshua said, when he answered the question, which is the greatest commandment or the most important, and he said, First, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And then he said, and the second one is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Too often we hear that as number one and number two, that this is the most important and this is a secondary. But he doesn't say that. Even in English, if you listen real carefully, he says, and there is another one just like it. Meaning they're actually the same thing, just stated differently. And so what Yeshua was actually teaching his followers was, loving your neighbor is loving God, and loving God is loving your neighbor. They're intimately connected. There is no such thing as, I love God, but I don't love my fellow human being. There is no such thing as, I love all my fellow human beings, but I don't love God. They're intimately connected. It's a chicken and egg. Which comes first? It's a circle. Loving your neighbor is how you love God. And how and loving God is how you love your neighbor. Okay, so this is this integral circle here. And with this in mind, Yeshua's words, as they are recorded in John 13:35, are best understood. He says, by this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Now you see the connection there between loving God and loving one another. He also taught elsewhere in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, verses 17 and following, that keeping the mitzvot, that is what we will soon discover as part of being holy, would be the distinguishing mark of God's children. In John, however, he teaches that loving each other would be the sign of true discipleship. The two aspects are obviously combined. As we practice God's Torah in the direction of loving each other, we are actually honing our spiritual ability to love God. Remember one of our key idioms? As below, so above. Okay, so we have below and above. Loving your neighbor. And by the way, that's the parable of the Good Samaritan answers the question, who is my neighbor? But loving your neighbor is the fractal, or not the fractal, it's the flatland world of action of loving God. Okay? So when you love your neighbor below, it's actually loving God. So there's that intimate connection. So your discipleship below is actually expressing a spiritual reality from above. And the reverse would be true. The lack of loving your neighbor would express a lack of true love of God. So they're combined. As we practice loving God, we love our neighbor. And as we practice loving our neighbor, we're honing our ability to love God. So it's a circle. Loving God and God's Torah is what leads us to love one another. And loving one another helps us understand how we are to love God. And the circle begins again. Now, we're going to kind of flesh out a lot of this through the class this evening. But that's kind of getting us going. Now, train up a child. It's interesting that our parashat begins this circle of loving God and loving neighbor with the first relationship of love. Our parashat begins with that love that's between the child and his or her parents. The parashat states, every one of you shall reverence his mother and his father. But did anyone notice what's connected with that mitzvot? It's really interesting. It's one of those things that at first doesn't make sense, so it should have been a radar for you. Okay? Should have reverence for your mother and your father, and you shall keep my Sabbath. Not like you should obey them, or, buy them birthday presents, or anything like that. You should respect your parents and keep my Sabbath. And so they're connected. Okay. Now, why is Sabbath plural? Are there more than one in a week? Why is it plural?
Because every Sabbath.
Yeah, all the festivals are also called Sabbaths. Sabbath is not just Friday evening to Saturday evening. Yom Kippur is a Sabbath. Passover is a Sabbath. Sukkot is a Sabbath. All of the festivals are Sabbaths too. But there's this linking between reverencing your parents and keeping the Sabbath. Again, at first glance, this appears unconnected. But the answer is actually kind of, it's right there. If a child is taught from their beginning to reverence, which, by the way, the Hebrew word being translated there is yirah, fear his parents, but again, that appropriate fear, not the negative fear. He learns all the important lessons of submission to authority. And in that vital lesson, he also takes the first step towards understanding his need to submit to God's authority as his father, the outworking of which will be to submit to God's control of time and their willingness to worship the way God has said to worship. So again, we go to our as below, so above. Your attitude towards your parents, and for that matter, any authority. Again, you wondered where our catechism drew that connection in the commandments to honor your parents, to relating to authority. Now you know it. Your attitude towards your parents is your attitude really towards your father and above. Okay. And so if you train up your child in the way they should go in the Torah, then what will they be doing? They will be keeping the Sabbath and so forth. Okay. So children learn their worship patterns from their parent. Here's a simple illustration. The relationship of love between each other, in this case between the child and the parent, advances us in our abilities to love God. So as we learn to love our parents, we're actually learning above how to love God. They're connected. And again, we can reason in the opposite direction. If we have developed patterns of bitterness and hatred towards our fellow man or towards our family, it's logical to assume that we will be hampered in our attempts to love God as He ought to be loved. If we can't love one another down here, we cannot love God. This is the fundamental principle of the Torah, and it's echoed by Yeshua in the Gospels. That's why he said the second one is just like it, meaning it's the same thing. You can't separate these things. Okay? This is
your view that a child from your father.
I didn't understand what.
What if your views by your father?
Well, I mean, we'll talk. We can talk about that later. I mean, there's an answer to that and so forth, but we'll keep going. But I'll answer that privately with you so that we can stay on track. The Torah not only teaches against the bitterness and anger and hatred of our fellow human being, not only teaches against it, but it outright prohibits it. We are to love our neighbor as ourselves. Now, for those who are in church on Sunday, this is what our sermon was about, right? And what did I tell you about that word for love? In the West, what does love mean? I mean, I love ice cream. I love my wife. Same thing? Okay. Guess what? Our language has one word for love. Biblical languages don't have one word for love. So when you're called to love your neighbor and even your abusive father, does not necessarily mean there's any emotion in it at all. Doesn't mean there's butterflies in your stomach. It doesn't mean it makes you feel good at all. It may actually make you feel horrible to do this. The love that this is speaking of is a love of the will and a love of commitment, not a love of emotion. Okay? So we're called to have this love of will, this intentional love for our fellow human being. If God's Torah prescribes a penalty for a certain action, then it must be administered, so our Torah tells us this week. But it's trying to balance that even in the enactment of justice, our hearts are paying for that member, and we would rather them experience the solace and peace of Torah. And this is a little bit later on, we're actually going to deal with, okay, what do we do with all these stone them, and we don't stone people and all that. We're actually going to find out, they really didn't stone them back then either, and they weren't disobeying the Torah. This is where it comes down to a community understanding, and that the whole community had to issue this decree. And it's going to make a lot more sense of Yeshua's statement about he is without sin. Okay, Yeshua wasn't saying something light, bright, and never heard of. The reason they didn't say a word is because he was actually quoting what they already knew. So keep this in mind, okay? Because this section of Kedeshim is loaded with all that. Take them out and stone them and so forth. Well, how do we deal with these passages? We deal with them the same way they dealt with them back then. Okay? The death penalty was so triggered that it was almost impossible to carry out. Okay? It was there, and it represented a strict form of justice. But when it's balanced with chesed, it was almost impossible to carry out. Okay? So we'll flesh that out too. Now, the arrangement of our Torah section makes another emphasis. This love and compassion for our neighbor is not found in disregarding God's laws in favor of my own feelings and perspectives. We cannot lower the standard of God's justice to accommodate our notions of love. In other words, we cannot say, well, I don't like the Gevurah. I don't like what it says about what's supposed to happen because I have this big chesed heart, this bleeding heart. And so I'm going to favor on that. Again, the idea is to balance them. How do we bring them in? And that's what this Torah section's really coming to. And the only way you can do it effectively is within community. If you are not within community, you cannot do it. You cannot do it if you are not in community. Okay, this section is really emphasizing, among other things, community. If you're on an island all to yourself, you can't balance it. You can't do it. Okay, because you're going to tend to be one of these things. That's going to be your nature. And we all know, right? Take the speck out of your own. We can't take the speck out of our own eye, right? It's hard. We have to be balanced. That only comes in other community members. Okay? Now, society in general, and our society in particular, cries out for caring compassion, for a sense that someone actually is concerned about their torn soul that's embodied in their sin-laden body. Yet if we were all able to do so as followers of Yeshua, if we were all able to apply the Torah of a loving God with resounding thunder of a judge's gavel, we've missed the great deal of what the Torah is teaching us here. We must learn how to tell our worldly neighbors and our workmates and our colleagues that the God who has all of these eternal standards, and He does, and we should never compromise them, it's also still the God who wants to heal and mend the broken soul and turn it upon the path of holiness. Okay, so the ultimate way in which we must be able to speak both truths, you know, this behavior is wrong, this is sinful, it's prohibited, it's displeasing, it's going to bring punishment. Those are all true, we can never compromise them. But they always must be delivered, balanced with, this is the God who also loves you, wants to embrace you, wants you to become holy. So we have to figure out how to balance this. Okay? The ultimate way is we must be able to speak these truths with the actions of our lives. That's how you're going to speak it. Okay? You're going to speak it again down here with your actions. Okay? The old saying, you may be the only Bible somebody reads. Okay? You may be the only Bible someone reads. Okay, so they need to see not only that you have certain principles and certain boundaries, they need to see that. But by the way you live, they also need to see you're compassionate, you're forgiving, you're understanding. Okay. They need to see that, and they'll see that in how you live. But it is clear that if we cannot bring ourselves to obey God by loving one another, then we're going to have to put on deceptive masks of religion to love our unbelieving neighbor. We're going to have to fake it. And guess what? Everyone can tell when you're faking your love for someone and you're faking your concern for someone. It's see-through. From bitterness, we will inevitably soothe our conscience by hiding behind the strict code of the word and proclaiming with judgmental tones of the debauchery of those dirty people in our midst. And we'll quickly hide behind our rightness in the matter. Well, we are right. So we're putting up our fence, and you're not welcome in. That's when you're actually wearing a fake mask of religion and not truly living it out. So think of the response of Yeshua, who without any compromise to the Torah's decisive judgment upon sin, nevertheless wept over rebellious Jerusalem with a broken heart for people who, created in the image of God, ought to be enjoying the bliss of walking with Him in holiness. True holiness knows what it means to confront, to rebuke, even to punish. But it also knows what it means to care, to hurt for, to hurt with, and do all that's within its power to let mercy shine through. This is why we have the apostolic statement that love covers a multitude of sins. Now, I want to explore the concept of holiness, since that's the title of our parashat. Now, we've been in Leviticus for several weeks now. And hopefully, if anything has become clear, it's that it's actually a very practical book. I hope that's been coming through. Like I said when we started it, this is the book, if you're deciding you want to read the Bible and all of that, you would not probably read. You'd be like, it doesn't really apply anymore. There's no temple, there's no tabernacle, there's no sacrifices. I'm not taking out anyone outside the city limits and stoning them. By the way, another point to that, not only one person stoned them. Every single member of the community had to throw the stone at them. Okay. So, if someone got caught doing adultery, do you think in the community there might be someone who's guilty but just hasn't been caught yet? And so his throwing the stone would actually make him liable of death for lying, for his false representation. So how often do you think they took the adulterer out back and stoned him? And that's why Yeshua said, hey, don't we have this principle of this only works when everyone in the community is not guilty of this? So how often do you think a whole community is only one person is going to be guilty of that? I mean, it's theoretically possible, right? Mm-hmm. But probably not very likely. I'll let you know how often the death penalty was carried out. So it's been a very practical book, and we may not have expected it to be that, but it speaks quite a bit about life in the 21st century, very down-to-earth principles. For those who've been with us for a while, you may remember when we were in Bereshit, the book of Genesis, how I explained for many weeks that the idea of separation was key to the study of Torah. Remember that whole idea of separation? That's how, when God created the world, He separated. That's how He brought peace, shalom, and order to things in the garden, is that He separated the chaos. He separated the day from the night. He separated the fish and the beasts of the field. He did lots of separation to bring order. And time again throughout, I try to bring up this idea of separation. Okay? Periodically in Shemot, we came across that idea as well, the book of Exodus. In reality, that is really what this book of Leviticus is all about. Now, I want to ask you, what does holy mean to you? Don't cheat and try to tell me what you think it means, or what you think I want you to tell me it means. What really comes to mind when I say, or when you hear the word, be holy, because I, your Lord, your God, am holy, and that we serve a holy God, and I want you to be holy. What comes to mind? Or that's a holy person. Perfect purity. Kind of also gets taught in some churches, you really can't be holy. Somebody hasn't been reading the Torah. Somebody's thinking Greek, not Hebrew. And kind of like the word perfect, what do we think of usually? Never makes a mistake, never sins, all that. That's not what perfect means in Hebrew, or by the way, even in Greek. So a sinner, biblically speaking, a sinner can be perfect. A sinner can become perfect. Biblically speaking, not the Western definition of perfect. Okay. Same thing with holy and holiness. Set apart is really where we're going to start taking off with this, okay? This parashat's really going to give you what it looks like. It's not going to give you the theological concept of holiness. That's a Western approach. Let's write a book on holiness. If we were German, it would be a 6-volume set on holiness. If it were English, it would be a history of holiness in the British Empire from 1700 to 1980, you know, and there would be volumes like that because they only care what happens about them. You know, if it were French, it would be how the holy people eat, you know. Okay, so what is holiness from a Hebraic, biblical, Torah perspective? What does this word really mean? That's what Leviticus is going to give you. It's going to give you, because Hebrew's concrete. It's just nuts and bolts. So it's going to just say, look, I'll just let you see it. Okay, that's what's going to be going on here. It's going to be taking off in this set apartness. And so in many ways, what God is saying when he says he's holy, he's like, I'm set apart. You can take, you know, all the gods of the world. The reason I'm holy is not because they're sinful and I'm not. It's because I'm not in their category. Okay? I'm separate. Remember the whole idea of separation? Okay? I'm separate. And so the call for people who are holy are those who live separate. Now you can live separate and still be a sinner. And you can still make mistakes. But you can still be separate. And how you deal with the mistake and what you do about the mistake, which is all included in this stuff too as well. Because by the way, part of perfection, biblically speaking, is repentance. Now think about that. Part of perfection is repentance. This is why Yeshua goes and is baptized in a baptism of repentance. Even though he hasn't sinned, he still has to repent. Because it's part of perfection. Now you know why he goes and says this has to be fulfilled. I have to do teshuva. I have to do it. Whether you think I need to do it or not, I have to do teshuva. Okay, so we're going to really kind of break down holiness. And again, throughout all of this, you've got to drop the Western understanding when we say holy and perfect. You've got to drop it. Hebrew is much more practical, much more concrete. So we're going to go right now, we're going to expand upon it, but go right now with holiness simply means separation. The separation of the sacred from the mundane. Separation is what brings shalom and order out of chaos. So Leviticus is really a book about how to bring shalom and peace to your life. And it's done through separation, just as it was at creation. Now, it's no wonder that this is the first book taught to little Jewish boys. It teaches them how to be men. What's severely lacking in the church and in our society at large? Little boys are not taught how to be men. But it more specifically tells them how to be men of God. It teaches the real, practical, everyday principles of living as a person of God. Now, so far, some of the things we've learned are that people who are holy, separate, they're separate in how they worship. Remember, don't go monkeying with anything in the tabernacle or its worship service. Partially because it's a fractal Messiah and you're monkeying with who Messiah is. But also, separate. So don't be bringing in things that the other people over here are doing. So you're separate in how you worship. Remember, we learned how we're separate in how we eat. Okay? Remember, we're separate in how we act and behave in marriage. And we did the whole understanding of the laws of family purity. Last week, we're separate in how we do business. We leave the corners of our fields open. We're generous in business. Okay? And tonight we're going to see there's lots and lots and lots more. But for time's sake, we're going to hit some of the highlights. Now, when we hit some of these highlights, I emphasize they are highlights. So I'm not giving you the exhaustive understanding of those verses. And when I skip over a few verses, I'm not saying those aren't important. I'm saying for time's sake, I had to do what I had to do. That's why it's an annual cycle. And next year you'll be reading it again and do some more, okay? So these are highlights. But I want to bring home how they still are applicable to us today. So Leviticus 19, verses 5 through 8. The issue here revolves around the need to set the sacrifices apart as special in light of merely slaughtering them for food. Seems like somewhere in Paul's discussion in a couple of books, he talks about this whole sacrifice and eating the meat business, right? Kedoshim, folks. That's when he comes to the conclusion, well, technically you could eat it, it's just meat, those aren't real gods, nothing really happened there. But he ultimately makes the ruling, I really wouldn't eat from that. Why? Because we're separate. Okay, not that somehow the meats become evil meat, because it's offered to a false god, it's nothing. But it's like, but somebody might think we're in this then, and we're no longer separate, we're no longer holy. Okay, so this is where he's getting this stuff. And so here, the idea that one could offer both a sacrifice while at the same time prepare meat for the family would detract from the sacrifice being primarily given to God as an offering. So the meat eaten by the worshiper and his friends, his family, his clan, could be consumed only for 2 days. On the third day, the meat was no longer to be eaten. And we spent some time on that as well. That ties directly into why Yeshua rose on the third day. The severe penalty attached to this was being cut off. And it emphasizes again the point that God intends his worship to be entirely set apart to him. So again, we come to that theme that the worship of God is serious business. Remember again Aaron's sons. The worship of God is serious business. Verses 9 and 10, the poor and the foreigner, that is the non-Israelite, are put together as those in need. This was because both were not landowners, but the poor could become a landowner if their economic status changed. The foreigner, however, could never own land permanently. In many ways, that's still in effect in Israel today. If you're not an Israeli citizen, you really can't own property unless you pull some strings and get creative and so forth. But the idea is they really don't want foreigners owning their land. And that kind of makes sense. What happens if a bunch of people from Hamas or Hamas supporters that got really rich and started buying some land? Might be a problem for them, right? And even in biblical times, if it wasn't because they would take over and attack, what would they do, though, to your culture? Mommy, can I go play with the... Can I go to the Moloch Youth Conference? All right, so the foreigner wasn't only impermanent. What is more, the foreigner is connected with the poor because apart from marriage into the clan, he had no family ties that would guarantee support. So unless the community as a whole, here's our emphasis on community again, unless the community as a whole made provision, and they did this by, again, leaving the gleanings where people could glean, they couldn't go over a second time and get what they missed, they left the corners of their fields open, they had to be generous in their business practices and so forth, unless the community as a whole operated this way, both the poor and the stranger would suffer, i.e. the rich would get richer and the poor would get poorer. This law is set forth in the Torah, shows that it has always been God's purpose that the foreigner be included as part of the larger community. That's another subtle theme I told you to pay attention to way back in Genesis. This idea of the incorporation, the ingrafting of the Gentile, the foreigner, the alien, into the people of God. We have another fractal of this here. These laws here are being very intentional that you are not to shoot a foreigner off. There are certain restrictions for them, but they are to be taken care of and welcomed into the community, and they can even marry into the community and so forth. That would also imply conversion and so forth. But also, again, you see generosity is to be part of any person in the community is to be generous if it claims that it is a godly community. 11 through 15, stealing and lying. And they're actually connected with swearing falsely. Since as those who worship Hashem, God, day and night, we know that he intends to every word we speak. So there really is no time he's not listening or involved. And both, or actually all three of these, stealing, lying, and swearing falsely, all desecrate the name of God. This is important from a Hebraic point of view, because names in Hebrew aren't just names, as we've talked about. A name in Hebrew, again, is someone's character, it's their essence, it's their reputation. That's what your name is. And so stealing, lying, and falsely swearing demean the reputation, the character, and the essence of God Himself. Stealing and lying or swearing falsely are connected in this way. Not only is the one who actually is the thief guilty, but also all of those who aid or abet the thief by covering his sin, or by accepting items that he has stolen, even though it is known they are not rightfully his to sell. Well, I didn't steal that stereo, but I'm not really going to ask why that guy can sell it to me for, you know, $50 when it's $500 new. I'm not really going to investigate that at all. I'm going to ignore the serial number that's been polished off. I'm just going to pay $50 and I'm innocent. The Torah says no. No community can survive that not only has this within it, but that allows it to remain and becomes kind of secondary partners in it. Stealing is not only when one overtly robs another of his property, but it's also when one fails to pay what one owes. Okay, if you owe somebody money and you don't pay them, that is stealing according to the Torah. Workers who exchange their time for compensation are robbed if their compensation is not forthcoming. The Torah expects a worker should be paid immediately after they perform the work. Their payment is not to be delayed. If it is delayed, it's a form of thievery. Interestingly, the law regarding the deaf and the blind is put into this section. Like the poor, the stranger, and the worker, someone may easily take advantage of the deaf and the blind since they are vulnerable. So you see how the community is protective. The disadvantaged are to be cared for with special consideration, and thus the deaf and the blind that are listed are the most obvious disadvantaged persons of a society, especially at the time of Leviticus. So we see the Torah takes a strong stance on taking care of the least among us and the weakest in our society. Since our American society in many ways was founded upon principles of Torah, we've always made provisions for the deaf and the blind and taking care of those in hard times. And in societies that were built with no connection to the Torah, the deaf and the blind and the poor are often left to a life of abject poverty. But something for us to think about. The principle it's teaching is, again, the community is to protect the least and the most vulnerable and the weakest among them. Okay, you're only as strong as your weakest link kind of idea. So when we think about our American communities, who really are the most vulnerable and the weakest in our land? The unborn and the elderly. And you'll see the more we distance ourselves from Torah, the more they suffer. So there's the principle. That's what you got to look at. Remember, there's the Peshat. Means what it says what it means. And then there's the remez. What's it actually hinting at? What's the deeper principle? The deeper principle here is any godly community centered in the Torah protects its most vulnerable members. Verses 16 through 18. Here we go. Loving one's neighbor as oneself. Well, this is a mitzvah. And remember, a mitzvah often gets translated as commandment, but it's not a commandment. It means connection. These are ways to connect to God. So when you do these things, you're connecting to God. Loving one's neighbor means things like not being a gossip, nor is one allowed to stand idly by while observing his fellow human being being hurt. Again, this is where our catechism picks up on our eighth commandment about don't talk about your neighbor uselessly. It says, what does this mean? And it says, kind of not only the obvious stuff, but also that you have the responsibility to help your neighbor and help build them up. Give them the benefit of the doubt, best construction. So all of the mitzvot have kind of a positive and negative side. Like, thou shalt not murder. Yeshua lets us know it goes far beyond murder, right? That's the below. He lets us know above, you know, even if you think harsh things and, you know, wish just they'd lose all their money or they'd lose their business and so forth, that's murder, right? But then there's the other side. That commandment also calls you, therefore, to help your fellow human being, to make sure they don't get harmed. So the same kind of thing. Commandment carries both sides with it. Furthermore, loving one's neighbor as oneself means that one must be willing to resolve conflicts within the context of God's justice. You're not allowed to take your own vengeance, and submitting to justice is a form of loving one's neighbor. Now again, the Torah links physical actions with non-physical ones. This is the as below, so above principle. These two are linked, might indicate both a physical and a non-physical aspect is intended. The idea of gossip, okay, that's not physical, but it's linked with physical act. What have I told you it's linked with? It's linked with murder, right? In fact, the sages say it's worse than murder, because murder, it's one and done. I kill you, you're done. Can't kill you many times. But if I gossip about you, every time that's me killing you, that's me killing your name, then every time that person says it to someone else and they say it to someone else, you're killing that person again and again and again. Okay? And so a God-centered community will not tolerate this kind of behavior. Verse 19, the mixing of things is prohibited because our daily living is to remind us in every way how we are set apart to our God with an eternal covenant He has made. The mixing of cloth is specifically detailed in Deuteronomy 22, verse 11, to be restricted to wool and linen. No mixing of wool and linen. Now, this is because the high priest's garments actually did have this mixture. And so the common person was to be distinguished, separated from the high priest, even in the clothes he wore. And whenever you encounter aspects within the Torah that deal with mixing and not mixing, what does mixing sound like? And not mixing. It's the whole idea of separation. So it's Remez is teaching you some principle about separation. Wool and linen represent things. Meat and dairy, they represent things. 26 through 28. This section deals with matters related to sorcery. The opening line is, "You shall not eat over blood." It was common for sorcerers to use blood as part of their incantations and their attempts to cast spells and so forth. So from this section here, the sages derived that the butcher could not eat in the place where he was preparing meat. Sacrificial meat could not be eaten until after the pouring of the blood was completed. And that a Beit Din, that is the court that made moral decisions and other key decisions for the community, would fast on the day that they had enacted severe punishments, especially capital punishment. Now, the prohibition against all kinds of sorcery, you may think, well, I don't have a magic wand, I'm not guilty of that. Let me tell you how, in the Kumash there, how the sages of old broke this down. It included any pagan superstition. And I'll give you a few in modern. Knocking on wood, not to walking under a ladder, carrying a rabbit's foot, avoiding black cats. These are pagan superstitions because they're all rooted in pagan worship from a long time ago. The pagan religions died out, but their superstitions haven't. Okay? We're not in that bunch. We're holy. We're separate. We're not holy because we're better. We're not holy because you're worse. We're holy because we're not part of that. We don't mix with that. Also here, the rounding of the edge of the scalp and the destroying of the edge of the beard is included in this section as well. So what do you think it's linking this to? The rounding of the edge of the scalp and the destroying of the beard, if it's in this section, it's linking it with what? Pagan worship and, you know, sorcery and witchcraft and so forth. It is in this connection that these acts are prohibited. The pagans would often scar their forehead and the sides of their scalp and their pagan rituals as well as cut the sides of their hair in mourning rituals. So part of their mourning would be mourning when they were mourning and wanted their God's favor and all of this, and that this person would ascend to their version of heaven and so forth. They would cut their hair a certain way, which many what we would call a bowl cut. They would cut everything off the sides of their face and off the sides of their hair. They would often also scar the sides of their face. Again, this gets the God's attention, right? You remember this from Elijah and Baal. When Baal's not paying attention, what do they start doing? Start cutting themselves. And so what happens if you really cut, a man really cuts deep his face? What happens? What does? He'll never grow. Hair will never grow. Okay? And so that people never think, I'm that kind of God where you have to do those kinds of grotesque things. So that you'll know, people will know that I'm not that kind of God. And so they'll know you're not that kind of people. You won't touch the sides of your hair. You won't touch the sides of your face. Okay?
Tattoos,
that is related to a mourning ritual, and what's specifically prohibited in the Torah regarding tattoos are tattoos that are done for mourning purposes. So, and the modern day example is if your wife dies and you get her picture and her name tattooed on you, that is almost verbatim forbidden in the Torah. These mourning rituals, because that's what they did. Okay, so
what you're implying is that any tattoo is, in essence, from that pagan
ritual. Not necessarily any tattoo. The tattoo is associated, the Torah is associating them with mourning and remembrance. That you're keeping them alive and so forth
not
by your tattoo.
Not related to the issue, but it would be the same thing as if you put anchor here because you're...
Well, that would be what the rabbis would say, Akasha. You and five other rabbis could argue the minutiae of how far to interpret it. Kind of like, does it mean never cut your hair or don't cut it to the point where it's obvious you don't cut it? Do I really let it go to the floor or do I just make it obvious that I'm not cutting the corners of my hair? Okay, so you're actually going into a Western mindset of the scripture instead of the biblical mindset. So some forms of tattoos are specifically prohibited when they're involved in the ritual. Also, with the sides of your hair, when Yeshua is walking and a woman has an issue of blood, what happens? What does she do to get healed? Grabs the corner of his garment. Bad translation. What does she really grab? His tzitzit. What would that look like if I let them mangle the physical tzitzit? What are the tzitzit for? Book of Numbers. Remember the covenant. Remember the commandments. Remember your child of God. It's like tying a string around your finger. Okay? Verse 29. Parents are to protect and guard the purity of their children, not encourage or force them into a life of immorality. Lacking such protection and guardianship, the society falls inevitably into debauchery and the whole land is polluted. The point being that the office of parent, for lack of a better term, if it goes down, the whole community goes down. Parents shuck their duties. That family doesn't just suffer. The community suffers. Because what happens with the kid, with the parent who shuck their duties? Generally speaking, what kind of kid does he become?
Rebellious.
Does that just affect that family now?
No,
it doesn't. It affects the whole community. This is why we make a big deal about the whole office of family and parents and marriage. It's because God makes a big deal about it. And the link here in Leviticus is, as the family goes, so goes the culture. As the family goes, so goes the culture. That's the general principle being operated here. Okay? Don't get bogged down in the details. Look at what the general principle is. Okay? Verses 30 and 31. The worship of Hashem is not to be mixed with pagan worship, since in paganism, those who engage in those acts are often viewed as priests or priestesses of the demonic cult, especially with necromancy, the love of the dead, and so forth. And there are many ways you can fall in love with the dead other than the more obvious ones. Prohibition of this sort of thing is in contrast to their true worship of God in His sanctuary on His appointed days, including the weekly Sabbath. Again, the worship of God is to be done God's way and to be separate from any other kind of worship. If your worship looks like other worship, it's not holy. It's got to be worshiped the way God has prescribed. Verses 32 to 37. General kindness and respect is to mark the life of the Torah community. This includes reverence given to the aged, for their wisdom is to be sought after. The elder, which is literally the Hebrew word for sage, is one who's learned the lessons of life and whose counsel, therefore, is invaluable. To give honor to the seniors of the community is to honor God Himself. That's what the principle here is. So a society that does not honor its elderly, it's affronting God. It's an affront to God. Likewise, the foreigner is to be treated with respect, welcomed, and appreciated within the community. And again, we have a fractal of the foreigner and the eventual ingathering of the nations to Israel. There's also a discussion of correct measures and weights. Now, is this talking about you should have measures and weights in your business instead of a cash register or a computer? Okay. We'd be reading a little too much into the text. What's the remez? What's the real point? Integrity in what you do in your commercial and economic dealings. That's what's behind correct measures and weights. Cheating one neighbor in matters of commerce is to fail to love him as you love yourself. Thus, it's a failure to love God. Improper, that is, an improper business, when you run it improperly and you know you're running it improperly, the reality is you're not loving God. Separation is how we do business. People should know, you know, the term we is used in the church is kingdom business. People should know you're a kingdom business. Okay, but how you treat people. Someone comes, say you sell a product that has a warranty, it's a 1-year warranty, they come in 3 years later, you can technically say, nothing I can do. That's what everyone would do. What would the holy person do? See what I can do, right? I mean, sometimes you may not be able to do something, but let me see what I can do. Again, think separation for what holiness is. We're running out of time here. 21 through 8, worship of Molech. This included child sacrifice. It was the height of idolatry. Human sacrifice is the height of all idolatry in the Torah. I'll let you meditate on that a while.
Abortion?
Absolutely.
The human sacrifice for the selfish purpose.
Yes, I agree. That's absolutely. Just keep meditating on that. That's absolutely correct, without a doubt. Same with the elderly, too. There's more ways to sacrifice than just boldness. But also think, human sacrifice is always prohibited in the Torah. Always prohibited in the Torah. The community was to purge such a thing from their midst. If the community fails to do this, the text indicates God Himself will bring the person to an early death to end it. So again, you know, if you go to Israel and you go to Megiddo, which is in the Greek Armageddon, as you go up on the top of the mountain, there's a nice circle altar that's been dug up by the archaeologists. It's where they sacrificed children. Do you know what's on Armageddon now? Nada. Okay. Communities and nations that do not take care of their children and their innocent will suffer the wrath of God. The fact that the text turns immediately to a person who curses his father and mother also may indicate that such action was connected to the idolatry of Molech. Verses 1 through 21, penalties for illicit relations are now given. Some of the specifics were given earlier in chapter 18. Since the penalties were most likely stoning, except the one by fire, the whole community had to be engaged in exacting the punishment. This ensured a certain fairness and also the rarity of actually carrying out that extreme form of punishment. You can think of Yeshua, who is without sin. Okay. The whole community. It could not be just a judge. It could not just be three or four people. It could not just be a jury. It had to be a unanimous community decision. Okay? There are going to be some people who are guilty of that sin. They're going to have a problem executing that judgment and so forth. So, keep that in mind. The punishment's there. There is that punishment of death. But the whole community had to do it with a sense of purity and no bad motivations. This section is placed after the section outlining the commandments dealing with community relationships. So if a community is not strongly knit together along the lines of the statutes given in chapter 19, they will be unable to exact the penalties prescribed in chapter 20. Okay, so again, it's assuming a lot of things. The conclusion reiterates the need to live by God's statutes and decrees. All of them, even the separation of clean and unclean, is important in order to maintain the community in which Hashem's statutes may be maintained and lived out. Now, a summary of all of this. The primary repeated strains throughout this section are twofold. Be holy, because I am holy. And I am Adonai, your God. There is no other. So our life being connected to Hashem through His Son, Yeshua, ought to enact a metamorphosis within us. It ought to change us into the image of our Creator. And if we understand the Torah correctly, we will see that it reveals to us one who is infinitely compassionate and merciful while also being infinitely just and holy. As we mature spiritually and grow to become more and more like our Creator, conformed to His image, as Paul says in Romans 8:29, we are enabled to walk the delicate course between justice and mercy without compromising either one. When you actually study communities today who practice these principles, as I shared when we talked about the family purity laws, communities that actually practice the family purity laws, their divorce rates almost non-existent. Okay, so the idea that these are outdated principles and don't apply, the funny thing is when you study cultures and communities that follow them, their divorce rates are down, violent acts are almost zero, domestic violence is almost zero. The entire community acts as one family. I'll share with you briefly a story from someone who visited Israel, and they went into one of these neighborhoods, and it's known as Mea Sharim. Very guarded neighborhood, very, very much on knows how to live this stuff out. And most of the men there are on the Israeli government what we call welfare system, because the Israeli government set up that if you're a Torah scholar, it will actually supplement your income or give you money so that you can study the Torah. Remember, this is based in the tribes. Zebulon was to work to pay for Issachar, because Issachar was to be the teachers, and so they were to study and teach, and so they were to be compensated by Zebulon. The tribe of Levi, they were to serve in the temple and be priests and teachers as well. And so they had no land of their own. So they were, certain little sections were in all of the tribes. And where they were at, that tribe had to take care of them so that they could do the priestly duties and teach and so forth and help in those manners. That's still practiced in Israel today. As the tour guide was going through, he kind of mentioned that, like, in a negative way, well, these men you see here, they're living off our tax dollars and blah, blah, blah. But then he said, in a positive light, however, there's not one single old person here that doesn't get a hot meal every day. There's not one person living on the street. You know, husbands aren't beating their wives. No one's getting divorced. It's what we would call an Acts 2 community. But those early followers of Yeshua did, they weren't original with that. They were actually carrying on what they were already doing. Acts 2, verse 42, they continued. Meaning, they were doing it before. They continued meeting in their home. They continued living in this community way, but now centered on the teachings of Yeshua. So they continued living that Torah-based lifestyle. And what does Acts say? No one was without Everyone had their needs met, so forth. So it does make a difference. Sociologically, you can study it. And now with the internet, you can go home and please, fact check me all you want. Because I got nothing to fear. They have a lot lower rate. Go ahead and do it. Why is that? Why is it like that? And then you think even in our church, why is the divorce rate equal or higher in the church than by those who profess their unbelievers? Is it perhaps because we are no longer separate? That we tolerate it? Okay, well, we don't have time for our last two. They were really good. They were really good. That's right. I was going to flesh out more of holiness, more than separation. I was going to flesh it out a little more for you. Then I was going to talk about where Shimon Safet, that's Simon Peter, quotes this parashat in his epistle. 1 Peter 1:16 says, "Be holy because I am holy." And I was just going to flesh out from a Torah perspective what Simon Peter was getting at there. Okay, but we don't have time for that. All right, so a little different way we did it this week. I thought it was just the best way to kind of get through some of this very detailed specifics of what was going on in the parashat. We're trying to also let you see its implications now, the overarching principles. And an example of like leaving the corners of your fields and harvested. Serve on the board of directors at the Angels Attic. And in fact, what we were discovering was if people come to the Angels Attic to our dumpster at night and really raid it, I mean, just go to town. And in one way, we don't really mind. Just have to pay by the pound for our dumpster. So, you know, you unload a 50-pound couch or chair or something, that's, you know, that saves us bucks. But also, it got to be a problem because it kind of was messy. And then we also have storage bins that aren't garbage containers, but actually have stuff we want to put in the store, and eventually they started getting broken into and all of this. So actually what the manager did, he did a very kingdom business thing, a very Torah principle thing. The back of the building, literally in the corner here, there's a section, no dumpster, anything, and what they can't put away that day, he leaves there. He doesn't put like the junk there that they can't sell. Like he left a matching couch and recliner, fine condition. He just left it out there because they didn't have time to get it in. And he leaves other little things out there and so forth. And what we found is they don't mess with anything else now. Mm-hmm. And that's almost always empty when he comes back in the morning. But nothing else is messed with. And it's just surplus for it. Stuff literally that, you know, the storage bin and where they sort stuff on the inside, it's so full, they haven't been able to sort it, that it can't go in. I mean, we don't need to harvest it. Okay? So he leaves it unharvested. And it solved a crime problem. It solved a litter problem. And it solved a workload problem. And Angel's Attic, since he's been doing that, financially has increased. We had a few months now where we went negative because of our commitments to the clinic. It's positive again. And all in all, we're also obviously doing what for people? We're obviously helping people. If you come at 3 in the morning, you're not just a hoarder or I'm greedy and I want to put this on eBay. I mean, you know, could that possibly exist with some of that? Sure. But if you're doing that, you need help, and that's what we're about. So that's a business in Murray that literally leaves its corner. I was very impressed when our manager, Mike Crook, showed us that. And you probably know businesses that do the same kind of thing. And if you do, and you talk to the owner or the manager or whoever runs that, they'll tell you not only do they never regret doing it, but that they've been blessed far more than they could have ever imagined. It makes a difference. It makes a difference when you're rooted in the Torah. Now, keep in mind, none of this has to do with anything at all to do with your salvation. You got that right? Everybody got that. No one is doing these things to be saved. Exodus and the coming out of Egypt, their salvation already happened, already by grace. This is the now what? This is what you look like after.
How you walk it out.
How you walk it out. So, you know, the addicts, we're not leaving that out there to be blessed. All right, don't write your church to the check thinking God's going to write you one back twice as much. That's a no-no. Okay, it's just we take seriously loving our neighbor. So we love our neighbor. The rest takes care of it. But keep in mind, no works righteousness stuff. This is already people who have been saved by grace, living in grace, operating by grace. This is what it looks like. That is what discipleship is. That's discipleship. Okay? All right. Let us close with a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Noten HaTorah. Blessed are you, Lord, the giver of the Torah. Amen.